cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. William Shakespeare, Julius Caesar, Act 3, Scene 1. There should be a law against 4 a.m. Unfortunately, there isn't, which meant that I had to get up. I left my beautiful Daniel sleeping in my new big bed, but with the two of us and one very sprawly cat, there wasn't room in my old one, and found my sheepskin slippers. I shoved one sleepy foot down and felt something moist and furry and heard a crunch. Horatio raised his stripy head, ears pricked. I suddenly understood. I had complained about the last mouse because he had left it on the kitchen table. So he had found another place to store it, somewhere safe, somewhere hidden. I disposed of the corpse and left my slipper on the balcony to be dealt with later. Perhaps Daniel could cope with it. He was an ex-soldier, after all. The Israeli army's loss was my gain. I put on the coffee, then had a shower, scrubbing my feet with a lot of soap and a nail brush. A size 20 woman does really unpleasant things to a dead mouse in her slipper. I hate 4 a.m. Insula, where I live and work, is as quiet as an Egyptian pyramid at this hour. I am the only one awake, save for my faithful apprentice, Jason, whose proud duty it is to open the bakery and get everything fired up for my arrival. Teresa Webb, a craftsperson extraordinaire with a medieval bent, would be dreaming of ladies and unicorns. While Professor Dion Monk, retired professor of classics, murmurs juvenile satires in his sleep. Mrs. Dawson would be quietly smiling at reminiscences of a life well lived in society. Trudy would be dreaming of tulips and speculas. Moreau would be slumbering virtuously in pagan bliss. And Mrs. Pemberthy and her revolting little dog Traddles, the only flies in Insula's otherwise harmonious ornament, would be tossing and turning if there was any justice in the world. Mistress Dread might still be out and about, of course, I couldn't say. Hers is an exciting world of bondage, discipline, and leather, which I am content to admire from a distance. In other words, all was calm, quiet, and serene. As was I, so long as I had coffee. No one bakes bread without drinking coffee. I paired my second cup with a slightly failed croissant. I still can't get them right. They are perfectly canonical croissants, I suppose, but not anything like those of the proper artisan in Montparnasse, where I used to live. My theory is that croissants are like wine. The environment in which the grapes are grown is critically important in winemaking. No doubt croissants needed flour milled from wheat grown in French earth and butter made from the milk of French-speaking cows. And I probably need to bake them in a French oven in France. So opens The Spotted Dog, a Corinna Chapman mystery by Kerry Greenwood. It's another story set in Australia, this time contemporary Australia, and it's a combination of NCIS and the best bakery foodie mysteries out there. The Spotted Dog is populated, as you just heard, with many relatable characters, from our protagonist Corinna, a plus-sized baker, whom we meet on a sweltering summer morning, she hadn't gotten to that yet, in the coastal city of Melbourne. Early to work, as always, joined by her recovering addict apprentice, whose challah bread is legendary, as are his muffins, we soon learn. Her former Israeli army officer, lover, confidant, fellow sleuth, is still in Corinna's apartment upstairs, asleep. Well, a look out her bakery's back door offers an unsettling sight early in our story, as she writes. The sun was already striking hot and golden down the alley. Once summer arrives in Melbourne, it invariably outstays its welcome. Bushfires, parched lawns, Trudy, our gardener, swearing and collecting every drop of wastewater to keep her flowers alive. Relentless heat. I was sick of it before it started. Alas, the thing about weather is that it's compulsory. I caught the plastic-wrapped paper as the delivery cyclist flung it at my head. I wasn't going to read it until the baking was over. Bad news makes for soggy bread, and that's all the news we get these parlous days. better to skip straight to the crossword. Mrs. Dawson, retired society hostess and example to us all, was coming back from her early morning walk. She was clad in scarlet cotton trousers and a hand-knitted cotton jumper with a Welsh dragon on the front. She asked for a sourdough, was duly given the first loaf out of the oven, and gave me in return the exact change and a sweet smile. The city was beginning to wake. Inside, Jason has put his challah bread into the oven and was compounding the muffin of the day. I could smell the ingredients. Orange flower water, dates, pistachio nuts, and candied peel. Yum! Oasis muffins. The boy is a genius with muffins. I knew I ought to go back to the kitchen and mold my pasta dura, a light, white Italian bread with a hard crust that my customers loved. But instead, I remained in the doorway, brushing flour from my green apron, because down the alley came a man. The light was behind him. He was of medium height, stocky with short hair, jeans and a khaki t-shirt. Something about him said cop or soldier. His eyes flicked from side to side as if hunting for enemies. Snipers in Center Arcade? I didn't think it likely. He was moving uncertainly. Drunk? It must have been a monumental night to be weaving his way home at 6:30. He came closer, his boots ringing on the cobbles. Soldier, then. Close enough for me to see that he had light blue eyes with dark smudges under them, cropped black hair, tanned skin. He was shaking. No smell of alcohol, though. He held out a much-creased envelope, and I took it. It was addressed to Sergeant Alistair Sinclair. On the back was written, "Daniel Cohen will help you." The word signed Sister Mary. There was no way I was going to ignore anything which came from that admirable and formidable nun. What Sister Mary said went. She was, as one of her clients had told another, in dang big with God. "Karina?" the soldier asked. Scottish voice. "I'm Karina," I told her. "I'm Alistair," he replied. "They told me about you." And then he promptly slid out of sight. And so we're off on a mystery that takes us far beyond the confines of Calico Alley, far beyond the shores of Australia, hooking into the ancient rivalries so still terrifyingly active in the Middle East. We delve into the Dead Sea Scrolls, and because of Alistair's missing dog and his soldier owner, are taken into the fog of war in contemporary Afghanistan. Yet all the while, our story stays focused on Karina's neighborhood's goings and comings on this sweltering Melbourne December. Two separate break-ins, one after another in Karina's apartment block soon after the arrival of the Scottish soldier, one of them by a young Catholic zealot and the other by a mask-wearing ninja robber, put her usually quiet neighborhood on high alert and soon enough draw their and our attention to a North Melbourne suburb that, though some distance from her neighborhood, seems to be a new hotbed, not only for modest-priced housing, but for feuding East European mob families, too. Throw in an attempted computer hijacking through an intrusive malware program at the local Greek eatery, and then just enough ancient and medieval Catholic religious stuff that gets mixed in as a not obvious yet likely reason for those break-ins, to invest some Dan Brown intrigue, and Dan Brown is name-dropped in the story, the spotted dog is not your simple closed-door mystery. We are swept into the small neighborhood of the bakery, get glancing knowledge of an S&M madam, the local witch, a retired but still busy professor of religion, a newly opened 21st century music store, and a troupe of visiting actors practicing Shakespeare's Tempest. And, of course, the requisite by-the-book local Melbourne detective. Well, mix them all together with Karina and her lover, fellow sleuth Daniel, and we get a story that put together Karina and Daniel's steadfast efforts to solve what seem to be three different local mysteries come to confound our two sleuths when they try to piece together a common link among the missing dog, the break-ins, the general tumult, and the computer hostage event. Well, the point of any well-written novel is to take us away from our day-to-day humdrum lives and plop us smack dab into a different world, to meet characters who are new to us, but whom we'd like to get to know better, or stay far, far away from. Spotted Dog accomplishes both good novel goals in spades. We do get a good sense of place about Karina's neighborhood. There's a rooftop garden that Karina, Daniel, the professor, several others, find to be an oasis in their busy urban neighborhood. And with the ubiquitous urban alleys and heat catchment of all that pavement, the local Greek diner and the newly opened music shop, not to mention the bewitching sundry shop and other small businesses nearby, we get a real idea of this neighborhood in Melbourne by the ocean. But for all the local color presented to us, at the same time, I got the continuing impression that Karina's neighborhood could actually be found in almost any big city around the world. And yes, I do wish the author had done more with some of the supporting characters. Karina's apprentice baker, Jason, for instance, whom we met in that opening reading, has a compelling backstory as a drug addict in recovery. But in this installment of the series, we don't get to learn much about his past struggles, though he does serve as comic relief throughout the novel with his current Captain Horatio Hornblower fixation. And in like manner, Karina's lover, cum detective associate Daniel, has a mysterious backstory of his own, having worked with the Israeli Secret Service, the Mossad. His ongoing contact with his spy novel compatriots comes to light as he helps to solve the mystery of that missing dog, the Scottish soldier, and other goings on in the neighborhood, all of which goes to point out the wonders of our modern age when an Israeli undercover agent living in Australia can reach out easily and sometimes successfully to his colleagues in Israel far, far away. I found myself wanting to know more about Daniel, and I'm guessing you will too. Author Terry Underwood makes it clear, if once in a while, that the setting for this story is Australia, not America. For instance, Karina, our lead character, makes the point that, quote, we use guns in Australia, but we don't worship them or any constitutional amendment, end quote. Just one of the asides that seemed directed much more at the reader than at any character to whom she's speaking. These asides dot the book and remind us that not every corner of the world thinks and sees life as Americans do, even if they do speak English. Well, The Spotted Dog is clearly aimed at the mass market reader. Underwood's characters all express every person views throughout the story. Karina and her friends are certainly aware of the wider world beyond Melbourne, but are dismissive of politics as disheartening. They are happy to be at their day-to-day work without a crisis looming every moment or with every new customer who walks through their doors. And they find a daily comfort and joy interacting and mingling with their colleagues at work and their neighbors. Most of them, at least, are welcome touchstones of each day. Two, Karina and her friends enjoy their weekends. While some of the local businesses are open on Saturday and Sunday, they clearly have more relaxed hours of operation than those we're familiar with here in the States. And for Karina, Saturday and Sunday blessedly allow her to waken far beyond her Monday through Friday 4 a.m. out of bed times, at least when no break-in is occurring at her home or those of her neighbors. Well, let's wrap up our story, this story of food, a foodie moment, for one leaves this book hungry for just a bite of our favorite snack and maybe a glass of that wonderful Aussie wine that she refers to so often. Here she is, getting ready for breakfast, and what a breakfast it turns out to be. Karina, breakfast is ready. Open my eyes again to find Daniel kneeling by the bed and holding my hand. His hands are always warm. I lifted my head and kissed him. He carefully kissed me around the eyes. I imagined I could feel the bruising retreat under his kisses. I stood up, and he held out my dressing gown for me so I could climb into it. I tied the cord around my waist, and he led me into my kitchen, drawing out a chair for me. On the plate in front of me was a perfect eggs benedict on light rye toast, fresh broadleaf parsley from our garden upstairs, and a side order of bacon, several rashers thereof. Along with a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice and steaming mug of coffee, I fell upon it like Saul smiting the Philistines, admiring as Daniel sat opposite me and tucked into not so much a big breakfast as a breakfast to feed a medium-sized school canteen. There were poached eggs, grilled tomatoes, sautéed mushrooms, Cumberland sausages, spinach leaves, guacamole, and a double helping of fried bread. I drank my coffee thoughtfully and wondered if I dared to raise the subject with him. Jewish dietary laws were matters we had skirted around and never really discussed. Most people know the word kosher, though I gathered it was far more complex than pork and seafood. These were undoubtedly forbidden, but there was a lot more to it than that. I wondered how modern Jews felt about rules that probably made a lot more sense when you were wandering around in an unrefrigerated desert. I had no memory of raising the question before and debated the respective merits of asking or keeping a tactful silence. I decided upon the former. "Daniel, darling," Corina said, "I hope you don't mind me bringing this subject up, but I'm curious. This bacon is amazing, made no doubt from animals raised in a spa and massaged daily by muscular use and exciting loincloths. But what is the story here?" My beloved smiled his most melting, slow-eyed smile. "Oh, you mean the zebra? Yes, it's really good, isn't it?" And he shoveled another strip of it into his delectable mouth. "Zebra? Black and white striped horses with attitude? Those zebras? Oh, yes. Just outside Tel Aviv, there are huge zebra farms. And it tastes just like bacon, or so I believe." I considered this while helping myself to more of it. "So as you drive past these zebra farms," Corina said, "do the inmates make any noise in particular?" He gazed at the ceiling. "Oink." I gave up. His personal interpretation of Judaism's dietary laws was no business of mine anyway. I gazed at the Saturday Age to see if anything took my fancy, but after a few minutes of that, I folded it up and put it face down on the chair. I exchanged a look with Daniel, and his chin inclined. "Quite right, too. I think I would prefer to read a book. The news from abroad will only spoil your breakfast, and that would be a pity." "A tragedy," I concurred, but made no move towards my bookshelves. First things first. Before long, I was gazing at a platter swept clear of everything that had so recently adorned it. Even the hollandaise sauce had been mopped up with my toast. "And so, before you set out on your adventures, Daniel, let's consider our sources. Is there anyone we have forgotten who may be able to help us?" "It's quite a story. It's kind of fun to read stories set in December in Australia because the weather's quite different from ours, and this one introduces a cast of characters I'd like to meet again. I think you will, too. The Spotted Dog, a Corina Chapman mystery by Carrie Greenwood. It's available at all of our fine libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library."